Okay. Talk a little bit about pro forma statements. Talk about some of the elements falling out of the cash budget, and some other ones just come from assumptions we would make. So what pro forma statements do for us is they show effects of the firm's decisions on future financial statements, in particular, you know, what's our net income going to be, what are asset requirements, and so on. And then what effects of alternative decisions would be in sensitivity analysis on those changes. When we look at building a model in a spreadsheet, one of the great things about a spreadsheet model is that we can conduct sensitivity analysis very easily, and it's a very important part of the risk analysis for the company. Typically, when we think about projecting financial statements, balance sheets, and income statements, we assume that some of those items stay constant as a percentage of sales as sales vary. And so, in other words, if we think about a company growing in sales over time or changing in sales over time, some of the things on the income statement and balance sheet would tend to hold the same percentage of sales over time as sales vary, and others would tend to stay relatively constant as sales vary. So in general, on the income statement, we're looking at accounts receivable and inventory, and or on the balance sheet rather, accounts receivable and inventory and accounts payable as holding a relatively constant percentage of sales, and cost of goods sold and some operating expenses on the income statement would tend to maintain a constant percentage of sales. And many other things would tend to stay constant as sales change. And when we're building pro forma statements, we always need a plug figure someplace, unless it's a textbook problem. But typically, that's just to get the balance sheet to balance. So you need something that's the fudge factor. And the fudge factor can be a number of things. It can be cash. It can be notes payable. It can be retained earnings. So we'll look at how to do plug figures in that a little later. Things to remember about sales growth, and certainly with most of your companies starting out early and growing after that, it's very important to understand the problems that can come from growth. Anytime a company's sales grow, its investment, its requirement for accounts receivable and inventory in particular is going to grow, and if sales grow enough, its requirement for fixed assets is going to increase as well. That means as sales grow, we need to pour more and more money into financing these accounts that hold the things that make it necessary, that make it possible for us to do business. And that financing requirement gets bigger and bigger as sales grow. Also, since when we looked at the cash conversion cycle, we looked at the cash budget for Tyler Paints, it's very typical that your sales are going to grow and your investment in accounts receivable inventory is going to grow before your cash inflows start to grow. So there's a lag. So you're always behind the game. You have to pour money into financing the growth before the money comes out of the growth back to you. And so funding that gap when things are growing is very important. There's a piece on the right-hand side of the balance sheet that we call call spontaneous short-term financing. That's essentially accounts payable and trade credit. So it's called spontaneous because your suppliers who are giving you credit, the amount of inventory that you can buy from them will grow as your sales grow. The amount of credit they'll give you will grow as long as you're maintaining good payments with them. So it's not like you have to go back to them and ask for larger amounts of lending in order to buy more inventory from them. You just buy more, and you automatically get the credit that comes with it. So that's why it's called spontaneous short-term financing. So accounts payable are generally not things that we negotiate with our suppliers. They're just automatic. As sales grow, we may have an increase in profitability, but that's not always an outcome. In fact, I can think of all sorts of strategies where we could grow sales like crazy and have extremely negative profit. And the easiest way to do that is sell things below cost. And so we could have a situation where we have a company that has tremendous sales growth and it's just going to put itself out of business because it has no possibility of ever having positive cash flow. So again, the increase in current assets must be financed, and we either need internally generated funds, which is profit that we would get back out of our business each period, or we've got to have the money come from outside the company. And you can go bust by letting growth run faster than your cash. Internally generated funds with your companies are typically not going to be enough to finance the growth that you have in the first few years. So the amount of profit that you have, if any, positive cash flow that you have, would typically not be enough to fund that. So you have to look outside the company for additional sources of funding. If we don't have the ability to go outside the company and internally generated funds aren't sufficient, then a company would have some choices. Some of them aren't very good. One would be to reduce the growth rate, manage growth downward so that it's easier to finance, it's slower growth, so that it's easier to finance the growth of current assets that would be necessary for it. We could sell assets that aren't required to run the firm. Well, if a company needs money, the last thing it should have is assets that aren't required to run the firm. So we probably wouldn't have any of that. We, of course, could obtain new external funding if it's available to us. And depending on the situation the company is, it may have limited availability. Or we can reduce and stop paying cash dividends. Again, if a company is in a situation where it needs external funding to fund its growth, the last thing it should be doing is paying dividends anyway. So that's probably not going to be an option in many cases either. The formula that we'll look at, just an easy way to think about the amount of funding that would be needed, this additional financing needed. In your book, in this edition, it's changed the way that it's called, it EFR, which is external funding required. It's the same thing.
My question is actually on the last slide. Okay. And I could be totally wrong, but I always thought that you weren't supposed to stop paying dividends or reduce, and that was like a negative symbol to your shareholders. Is that right? So how could you do that?
Yes, that is one of the great myths.
There is no way.
That is one of the bad decisions that a company would make. And yes, they do make a decision on that basis many times, but it's not a good decision. We talked about the idea of dividends on financing a company. The basic dividend decision for a company should always be, if we keep this money, we have first we got to have excess money. Okay, so we got to have money that is not needed for the company, to not needed for investment. So if we've got excess cash sitting here, our choice is keep it or pay it back. We should pay it back to investors, unless if we keep it, we can do better with it than they could do with it if we paid it out to them. So if we have something productive to do with it, we can invest it in the company, and we can make a rate of return for our investors on that money that's at least what they could make if we paid it back to them and they invested it in some other company of about the same type as ours, then we should keep it, and they should thank us for it. And if we don't have that opportunity, we should pay it back to them. Because as a common stock investor, you get your rate of return in two ways. You get your rate of return either by the dividends that the company pays to you or by the increase in the price of the stock over time. And in theory, you don't care which it comes in. If your required rate of return for a company stock in order to want to keep it is 15% per year, then you can take a 15% dividend yield and no price increase, or you can take no dividend and a 15% price increase, or some combination of the two that adds up to 15%, you shouldn't care. You should be indifferent. And so, other arguments come into play about signaling and, we have investors who depended on, we paid a steady dividend for the last, 30 years, and we've got investors who own our stock and now they depend on that dividend. And if we cut our dividend, we're hurting those investors and they'll sell their stock. Well, it's all BS. And so the only decision that should be made is, can we do more with the money if we keep it than if we pay it out? And so that's one of the bad decisions that can be made within a company because of looking at the idea that, gee, if we've always paid this steady dividend, but, you know, gee, our revenues are in the toilet and our cash flows are bad, and we're going to have to borrow money if we pay this dividend, but, boy, we still got to pay this dividend, or people are going to sell the stock. That's all we... Okay, let's look at this idea for additional financing needed. The idea is we've got some ratios here that we expect are going to stay about the same over time. First one is assets to sales, and this says that as we increase sales, we're going to have to increase assets, current assets, possibly fixed assets, but that as sales grow, we're going to need more stuff. And so there's a percentage of assets to sales that we expect to stay about the same. So our requirements for funding, our requirements for assets is going to grow as sales grow. The second one is spontaneous liabilities, L, as sales increase. That says as sales increase, we're going to get some more external funding automatically from our accounts payable, from our supplier credit. So that will help us fund this growth in assets that we're going to need. S0 is the current level of sales. G is a projected growth rate in sales over a near period of time in the future. M is the net profit margin on sales. Out of every dollar of sales, how much are we going to see in earnings for the company? And D is the cash dividend that we have planned for the company during the period. So additional financing needed says as sales grow, we're going to need more assets. We're going to have some spontaneous liabilities to help pay for that. And we may have some internally generated funds, some profit, some earnings that will help us pay for that increase in assets. If that's not enough, what's the difference? That's the amount of external funding that we would need. So the formula says, in words, what's the required increase in assets as sales increase minus the amount of spontaneous liabilities that we're going to generate to help fund that minus the increase in retained earnings that we're going to have to help finance it. And whatever is left over would need to be a new external funding. It's important to remember that as a company grows, that increase in funding is permanent. It never goes away. It's not a temporary need. We don't need to fund this for the next month or the next year. If sales continue to grow, it is a permanent investment that needs to stay there from that time on. And so the whole asset base, the whole investment base for the company is rising, and therefore the cost of capital, the actual dollar cost of capital, is rising as well. There's a formula that we can use for that using the notation we had, and basically it's just saying the same thing as it says up above. So AFN, or in your book EFR, is the ratio of assets to sales. So this says what are sales now and the growth rate. So this is expected for sales next period times the A to S ratio. So this is the dollar amount of new assets that we're going to need to finance that sales growth. This again is sales for next period, and the liabilities to sales says this is the amount of new accounts payable, spontaneous financing that we're going to generate. And this says here's the net profit margin times sales next period, 1 plus the growth rate. So this is our earnings from the next period, net income, minus whatever we pay out as a dividend. And the difference between all those would be new external funding that would have to be raised. Note down below is that those ratios are not constants and may not even be linear or continuous. We're looking at it in a short period of time. And if a company grows a whole lot, those ratios may be different than if it just grows a little. And so the faster a company grows or the larger it becomes, it may have differences in any of those ratios.
Dr. Holly, just to make sure I'm clear, those ratios, you said you want them to kind of stay the same as sales increase?
No, we're assuming them that they're going to for at least small changes in sales. But just to do that formula. But in reality, as sales change a lot, those ratios are likely to be different.
So for us, since we're starting up, they're going to change a lot. But once we're established and stable.
Yeah. From small companies growing a little bit or big companies growing a lot, then it's going to change those ratios to some extent. And there's a quick example here. I'm not going to go walk through all of it, but it's basically looking at a company that has information given there and working out, just plugging into the formula, what it would be. There's also a concept called sustainable growth rate. It's similar to the AFN or EFR idea. And it says how fast, what's the growth rate in sales that a company can sustain and not outgrow its ability to finance itself, making a few assumptions. One is that we've got those same ratios we looked at before and that they're going to remain relatively constant. But we're also going to assume that the company can raise new external financing in addition to the spontaneous liabilities that would come from the trade credit. And that it can raise new debt in the same proportion to equity that it currently has. So if we have a company, you know, large established company that on its balance sheet has a certain amount of common equity and a certain amount of long-term debt bonds, that the ratio, the debt-to-equity ratio, will stay about the same as the company increases its equity level. And so the main place that equity is going to increase is from the reinvested profits, the net income earnings that we would have at the end of a period. So as retained earnings are reinvested in the company, that's equity money, and that equity would generate additional borrowing power, and that debt-to-equity ratio staying about the same would mean as we earn equity, we'd be able to automatically pretty much raise additional long-term debt. So that growth rate could be sustained at that point if there wasn't enough money to finance a growth rate so that more than that was needed, either from equity or from new debt, then that would be outside the sustainable element, be an extraordinary situation. So the formula is based on assumptions that the firm only has common stock, not preferred stock, and possibly has debt, and then it's not going to issue new shares. It's just depending on the equity that it has plus retained earnings. The ratio of sales to assets will remain relatively constant as sales grow. Dividend payout ratio will remain constant. Assets to equity and therefore debt to equity ratio remains constant, and net profit margin remains about constant. So if we have those ideas, you get a nice little formula that comes out of that, looks like this. And you don't need to memorize this, but it's just something we can plug numbers in if we're close to that assumption. And it would say that the growth rate G star that we can sustain without needing additional new financing outside of what we automatically expect to have would be profit margin times one times the retention ratio, one minus the dividend paid out, and assets to equity ratio, and then same thing on the bottom with another term in front of it. So that would generate obvious couple problems in your book that would look at that. And the solutions that I did to the chapters in your book kind of walk through a different way than just plugging it in that formula. It puts it into statements, two balance sheets and income statements, and compares the two, so you see a little better what that's really implying. Okay, let's take a look at a couple other short things that I've got here associated with this. First one, let's look at EVA here. EVA, economic value added, is a concept that was started by a consulting company, Bear Stearns, Stern Stewart rather, about 10 years ago, and it's caught on quite a bit in finance and in corporate financial management since then. They've kind of got a copyright on it, but everybody uses it anyway. The idea is comes out of the fact that when we look at a traditional income statement, the income statement and balance sheet that you see normally are lacking in many ways. The income statement includes things that are not really income or changes in value and doesn't include things that are. And the balance sheet is not a reflection, not meant to be, a reflection of true value of what's in the company, either on the financing side or the asset side. So what financial statements are meant to do is give you raw data in a standardized format that is composed from standardized rules so that you can use it for analysis. It's not meant to tell you what's really going on or what the company is really worth or what value change really was for the company. It's not meant to do that. It doesn't do that. So it's important to know where the shortcomings are. One of the big shortcomings in an income statement, if we think about the net income figure for a company for a year. We talk also about value of a company. We talk a lot about value creation and how it's the goal of the company to create value for its owners. Well, how do we know when value is being created? What's the change in value during a particular period? It's not net income, because net income doesn't include some things that really are contributing to value, and it includes some things that aren't. So if we think about what the real value change is in a period, what real profit would be, it would be how much did the value of this company change from the beginning of the year to the end, or whatever period we're looking at. So change in value. But we can't estimate value directly. Estimating value for a large company is a very complex thing. That's one thing that the market value of the stock helps us do if the company is publicly traded. That market value of the stock is the average investor's opinion, the consensus of opinion of millions of investors, about what the value of that company really is minus all of the obligations that it has. So if we look at today's stock price in the market for IBM, then we multiply that stock price per share times all the number of shares of IBM stock that are outstanding, we get a number that's today's market value of the equity. That'll be very different from the value that's shown on the balance sheet, I can guarantee. And so that basis, if the market is working well and it's rational, which in general it is, then that market value of the equity, today's estimate of what the equity is worth, plus all of the debt obligations, is today's market estimate of the real value of that company, the total value. And if we can depend on the market to be an accurate estimator, then we could look at that market capitalization at the beginning of the year, market capitalization at the end of the year, and say, what's the difference? And that's essentially real profit for the company. If the company isn't publicly traded, we have a lot more problem with that. But the income statement itself is leaving out a very important part of that component. So even ignoring all the other things that are shortcomings in an income statement, one of the big ones is that, remember, the cost of capital. Cost of capital includes the cost of debt and the cost of equity, and the cost of equity is a big number. Remember, from cost of capital and from the capital asset pricing model, that common stock always has a higher cost than debt, much higher. So the cost of equity is a big number. It's not in the income statement. In the income statement, you have an interest cost if the company has debt, so you'll see an interest expense, but you don't see anything for equity. And that's a huge cost for the company. It's not a cost that has to pay out directly in cash, but it's a cost nonetheless. And so we need an adjustment for the income statement that helps us get it closer to what the real change in value for the company would be. This is particularly important for multi-division companies. If we could take this measure and say, gee, if a company's got, you know, six divisions and all of them are doing something different, which ones are really contributing a lot to the company's value and which ones aren't? Or worse yet, which ones are destroying value for the company? And we would want to make capital allocation decisions so that we're funding the best, most value-producing parts of that company and not funding the ones that aren't producing value. So we need some way other than just the income statement for each of those divisions to know that. So what EVA does is try to give us an adjustment on the income statement. So in this example, we've got inputs up here. First one is a tax rate for the company. We're assuming a cost of equity for this company of about 15%. We're assuming that the before-tax cost of debt is about 10%. And let's assume that we've got a market value of debt that's about $1 million and a market value of equity that's about $3 million. So our total market value of capital in the company is $4 million. And we're going to make an assumption here about operating profit, EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, as a percentage of capital, just to give us a number down below. So out of those inputs, we've got an after-tax cost of debt of about 6.6% and a weighted average cost of capital, using the weights here, of about 12.9% for the company, and a high cost of equity, 15%. So for an income statement for this company, let's assume, using the 20% up above, we won't worry about all the other things, let's just assume we've got about $800,000 of operating profit. This company would have a 10% interest cost on its debt, so it's got $100,000 interest expense. And that would give us $700,000 taxable income. Tax rate on that, 34%, gives us $238,000. So this company would show $462,000 net income. And that's an 11.5% return on capital and a 15% return on equity. So from that income statement, everything looks good. Company's making good return, got good, healthy earnings. But again, the cost of equity isn't in there. So what EVA says is, well, let's get that in there. And the way we're going to do that is, first, let's estimate the dollar cost of capital for the amount of capital we have committed. This company has $4 million committed, and its cost of capital is 12.9%. So in dollars, it takes $516,000 a year to support the debt and the equity. Okay. Now we go back to the income statement, and we say, all right, start with the operating profit before the financing part of the income statement. So that was our $800,000. Apply the tax rate to that. So we have $270,000 in taxes, so we'd have net operating profit after taxes. So in your book, they call that NOPAT, NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes, of $528,000. But now we've got to cover that capital cost of $516,000. So we take that off here, and we end up with value created of $12,000. That's a whole lot different than $462,000. So this is an indicator that says, well, this company is creating a little bit of value for its shareholders in this year, but not very much. If that number was negative, it would say, well, value is being destroyed. It doesn't matter what net income says. We're destroying value. We're not making enough income in the company to cover the real cost of capital during that period, which is a big number. And so the more capital a company has committed, particularly the more equity it has, the farther away from net income, that value figure is going to be in any particular period. So this is a useful measure for investors to look at a company. It's even a more useful measure for multi-divisional companies to look at their divisions, because they can quite accurately figure out how much capital is committed to this division, what is its cost of capital, so a different divisions would have different costs of capital depending on their structure and their risk. So we can easily risk adjust the cost of capital for a division. So finding those two things for any division in the company is relatively easy. And separating out the rest of its income statement is relatively easy. And so we can, division by division, apply this factor and say, what, is this division creating value for the company or not? And it's a pretty good and pretty clear indicator of what's going on. And so this would be good basis for companies that use this to redirect capital away from the divisions that are destroying value into the divisions that are creating it, and build those divisions and shrink the others or spin them off. So it's a popular measure, it's very useful, and it's very easy to do.
It's also, let's see, let me look at this spreadsheet.
Talked about working capital. Talked about that cash conversion cycle and that 60-foot pipeline with cash stuffed up in it. So here's a way to visualize that. Got some example figures here to begin with. I'm going to change this to something that's a little easier to work with. So I'm going to change it to 10 million. Okay, so we're making an assumption here. We're looking at a company that has $10 million of annual sales. We've got three measures here over on the side. Each of them tell us something about the current asset accounts for the company. The first one is days sales outstanding. That essentially says how many days of that $10 million of annual sales are on average in accounts receivable. How big is the accounts receivable balance relative to sales? And so this company has about 27 days of sales on average in its accounts receivable. Okay. And then how many days of inventory are outstanding? So it says out of all the sales, $10 million a year, dividing that by the inventory that we have, how many days of sales does that represent? So that's about 32 days. And then days of payables, that's our accounts payable credit that's being supplied to us, has about 24 and a half days. And if we take those, we take days sales outstanding plus days inventory outstanding minus days payable outstanding, that gives us days of working capital, which says how long is that pipeline. Okay, so this company's pipeline is 34.6 days. That's about average of what we'd expect for a manufacturing company. And so let's look at what it says in numbers over here. If this company sells $10 million a year, how much money is that? Well, it says it's got $736,000 on average in accounts receivable. That money is there permanently and needs to be financed. Inventory is about $882,000, accounts payable about $671,000. So it has a constant need for funding for current assets of about $948,000 for every $10 million of sales it has. If we have a cost of capital of 10%, that says that its annual financing cost to fund that $950,000 of investment in working capital is close to $100,000 for every $10 million of sales that it has. And as a percentage of profit loss, what that $95,000 is doing to us is it is cutting our profitability by almost 1%. That doesn't say that profitability is 1% less than it would have been. It says if our profit margin is 5%, it could have been 6%. Okay? So a whole percent can be a lot of difference. Whole percentage point can be a lot of difference on profitability, which is normally going to run 3-5% for a well-performing company. Another percent on that is a significant difference. Okay, now we start to see what some companies do on that. Let's change the numbers a little bit. I've got some extra figures over here. So Dell Computer is about 36 days. So I got 35.6 and 3.8. And 64.2. Okay, let's see what that says. First of all, let's look at them. Days sales outstanding, that's their accounts receivable. So they've got about 30 days to collect on accounts. Now, these figures, by the way, are for 2005 because this was the 2006 report from CFO Magazine. The new one for 2006 figures will be available shortly, but it isn't available yet. So this is what happened in 2005 for this company. Okay, so days sales outstanding, about average, about 30 days. But days inventory outstanding is only 4. So they have almost no inventory. They're using the just-in-time inventory idea, down to a very low point. So their inventory in finished goods, in raw materials, in anything, like 4 days, very short, okay? And their days payables outstanding is almost 2 months. That says they're getting 2 months of credit from their suppliers, and they don't need 2 months because they're collecting in 36 days on average. So, and even if we add the days payables, the days inventory on that, basically 40 days is all they need, and they're getting more than 60. They've negotiated with their suppliers because they buy so much, such long credit terms, that they've taken that cash conversion cycle and inverted it. So they have more free financing from their suppliers, 20 days more, than they need. They've got 20 days of free financing. That's just a gift from heaven. And so that type of reversal, if you can go to a negative cash conversion cycle, which is what they have done, now they're not, they've lost some of this edge over the last year, but it's still, some of it's there. But they have a negative cash conversion cycle. So it's a, they have more funding than they need to fund their growth. If you're in that situation, what it says basically is you can grow as fast as you want to, because you got all, you got more than enough funding to fund that growth in terms of what you would need in current assets.
Let's look at some other ones here. Let's look at Walmart. Walmart is 3.1. And 37.6. And 29.6. Okay, so Walmart is going the other way. Walmart needs a lot of inventory, so they've got 38 days of inventory. They don't sell basically anything for credit, so their accounts receivable balance is very, very low. Essentially, all that represents is that's how long it takes to collect from bank cards. So they basically don't give any credit to anybody, but it takes them a few days to collect when you use your Visa or your MasterCard. Okay, so they've got that much day sales outstanding, they've got a long account days inventory outstanding, and they've got a sort of normal payables. So they only have a cash conversion cycle that's 11 days long. Of all the sales that they have, they've got almost nothing in that pipeline. So their accounts payable is almost enough to finance their requirement, and only a little bit of their own. So again, looking at the numbers on the side, for every $10 million of sales, they're looking at a very small financing cost for that 11 days per $10 million of sales, and the percentage against profit is also very small. So they stores like that that don't need to take accounts from their customers have a very big edge. And another interesting one here is GM. And again, they're worse than this now. This was before. So 288 and 32 and 60.4. Okay. So here's GM's cash conversion cycle. 288 days of sales outstanding, that's worse than that now. How on earth could a company have have accounts receivable representing 288 days? How'd they get that way? Who's GM's customer?
The dealers.
The dealers, right?
That's how long it takes the dealers.
Yeah, it's not you and me. It's the dealers. Dealers buy GM cars, and of course, fleets buy them too, but basically dealers are where most of that is. If you're a GM dealer, GM comes to you and says, well, gee, you know, we want you to sit, you know, 300 vehicles on your lot, but you have to pay for them in 30 days. What are you going to tell GM?
No.
So GM has a choice. GM can either ship vehicles to the dealers when the dealers need them. The dealers can do just-in-time inventory. But then GM, which needs a constant production process, you know, they can't produce cars today and not produce them for 6 days. They've got to produce them constantly. And so cars are coming off those assembly lines every day. They're going to have to put them someplace. They're either going to have a huge inventory lot at each one of those factories and ship to dealers as the dealers need them, or they're going to have to give some sort of incentive to the dealers to take the inventory and let the dealers store the inventory. Well, the only thing they can do is say, well, you don't have to pay for them until you sell them. And it takes this, you know, right now it's taking a long time to sell GM cars. And Ford looks just as bad. So they have a huge accounts receivable. They have money. They've spent the money on making all those cars. They've spent it on the labor. They've spent it on the inventory. Notice that their inventory period's about 30 days. Okay, so, and their payables period's about 60. So they've got 60 days before they have to pay for the stuff that went into the cars, unless it's labor, and they paid for that earlier. So they've paid for all of those cars that are now sitting on the dealer's lot and waiting for the money to come back in. And that's how they got in trouble. So that's a huge gap. Major, major finance. For every $10 million, they've got net working capital. Look at that. For every $10 million of sales, they have to invest almost the whole $10 million just in net working capital. So they have an enormous financing cost for them.
Do the Japanese companies do anything differently, or are their cars just selling?
Both. They have much faster sales rate. They have much better production processes. They have much better just-in-time inventory production in their production processes. They have a lot more interchangeable parts, so they can use one part for a lot of different things. They have a much better order process. And so, yeah, they do. And they sell faster. So they have a lot of advantages. Here's an interesting tidbit. Have you heard that the MG nameplate is going to be resurrected? Okay, way back a long time ago, when we were kids, there was an English sports car that was an MG, and so it's nice little sports car, roadster, real nice little thing.
MGB also.
Yeah, MGB. Yeah, right. And so it hasn't been around for a while. The company's still been producing, but it's an English company, but not a great deal. So they've basically been under. So it has a lot of nostalgic value for folks like us. And so the nameplate is being resurrected, and it's being built. Parts are being produced by a Chinese automobile manufacturer, and it's going to be sold in the United States. But the kicker is this: the factory is going to be in Oklahoma. And it's going to be on an Indian reservation, and it will be owned by the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. And so, as part of being a part, and they negotiated the deal with the Chinese company, and they will employ Native Americans and others in this plant to build the car here from the parts that are flown in from China. But what happens with anything that happens on an Indian reservation? Yeah, they avoid all the taxes. And so in order to make this happen, they had to have the state of Oklahoma essentially, it's not quite give is not the right word, but they put in trust land that the factory will be on, which is close to a city, which was not part of the reservation. But anywhere in the country, local or state government can elect to put land in trust in association with an Indian reservation, or even not a reservation, just in association with Native Americans, with a tribe in the area. And once they do that, when putting it in trust, it says it becomes part of the sovereign nation of that particular tribe, and therefore it's exempt from taxes. And so the state of Oklahoma did that for this, and out of it they'll get some revenue. Certainly they'll have other people employed there. There'll be other spin-off economic impact that come from that, but it will be on that land. And in fact, that operation has, that plan of putting in trust land has helped the Indian Reservation, Indian Nations, build casinos in many places that you wouldn't expect to see casinos. Certainly, you know that the largest employer in Mississippi right now is the Mississippi Choctaw Nation, with its Philadelphia big casino. That's the largest employer in Mississippi. Detroit, the armpit of the world, as far as I'm concerned, having come from that area, has casinos in downtown Detroit, and the state. Legislature would not pass legalized gambling in Mississippi or in Michigan just like it was hard to do that in Mississippi. But they did find a reason to give a piece of land in the middle of Detroit to the Choctaw tribe of Michigan. And so there's essentially an Indian reservation in the middle of Detroit that now has casinos on it. And there's also a very large casino in northern Michigan near Central Michigan University that's part of the same tribe. So.
There was a story, I think yesterday, said that 150,000 houses in Detroit, and that's selling for 30,000, and $250,000 houses are selling for about 80,000.
Oh, it's yeah.
I mean, real bad shape. They need the casinos.
Yeah, it's I have the pleasure of going there on a trip at the end of next week. I'm just really looking forward to it. So.
Can I give them another old guy test? If you had an MGB and you went on a Giancana, what would you be doing? Giancana. What would you be doing?
I had an MGB, so I would want another one.
Too small.
It break too much.
It break too much, yeah. Giancana is one of those three times in those days.
Another tidbit, the Indian Native American tribes have lobbying operations in Washington that spend twice as much as the tobacco industry on lobbying for state and for land to be put in trust for various tribes around the country. Twice as much as the tobacco industry they spend. So it's a big... It's a big push. Lots of those going on. All right, next week, bring your computers. We're going to be working, as I said, with kind of a spreadsheet refresher and tutorial. And we'll spend all of the class time doing that. Okay, any questions or anything?
You know why they do that, right? They get this grand scheme. You heard the past, right? So this is, they got all together, all the chiefs got together and said,